Few people are as well known in the CPR industry as Henk de Vries, the former director of the de Vries wing of the FedShip shipbuilding empire. Now newly retired from his day-to-day role at the company, he reflects in this interview on his extraordinary career, which mapped precisely onto an explosion of interest in the superyacht industry. Henk joined the family firm in 1987 and rose through the ranks, playing a central role in the success of FedShip over the last four decades. He will continue to serve as an ambassador for the brand and discusses how and why he has left the future of the historic yard in very safe hands. I loved speaking with Henk for this interview. In his inimitable and charming way, he speaks very candidly about what it means to run a company like FedShip. I really hope you enjoy our conversation.
Henk de Vries, 40 years at FedShip. What does it feel like to...
It's really strange, Stuart. I had my last working day on April 30. Went for dinner that evening with HQ and the sales group, so about a dozen people. It was a lovely, warm evening. One of my assistants brought tears to my eyes when she went through a whole very personal story on how she and I worked on copy and on publication, mostly internal and corporate. And I'm a zealot for correct use of language. And I hate it when we do something in Dutch and people throw English words into it. So in her speech, she had a thing that says, so she used a very normal English word that Dutch people use in a certain context. And she said, oh, no. And then she replaced it with the Dutch one. So that was very much an in-joke, but she did a brilliant job. Then on May 1, the Thursday, I had, of course, to go to the shipyard because the owner of a new boat was there for a long meeting. So I was there for like 10 minutes. And I was profusely thanked that I'd come out of my hibernation. And then on the Friday, there was the handover of the new faith. And this time, Cousin Tom was sitting at the table with the captain. The captain was, everybody's under stress towards the delivery because there were alarms going off and on and people doing last minute cleaning and shit like that. And then it hit me. I'm actually enjoying this, waiting for the champagne to be opened. I have no responsibility whatsoever. And Tom looks really concerned. So that was nice. Then, of course, I had to rush off to Venice for the weekend with my wife. I was not going to join the group on the stage, but the customer dragged me out. He said, you have to be there. So, okay. So that was the beginning of my figurehead's ambassador role, I guess. And we had a wonderful weekend in Venice. There was an emotional lunch with the whole sales group that was there on the Sunday. And then Tineke and I stayed for another day, did some museum visits. It was lovely. And I came back. I think Tuesday was the first day I had nothing. No, that's not true. I had my final evaluation conversation with Farouk. I had an introductory meeting with a new person for the management of Water Revolution Foundation. So it was just like work. But it became less and less. And I'm now sitting at home. My desk is an absolute war zone because I dumped all the stuff from my desk in the office in a box. And the box is partially emptied here. And honestly, the big difference I remember very, very vividly when Tom and I became company directors in 1996. Mr. Moran, the famous owner of the 8-gallon ladies, we were building number 6 at the time, had said to us, oh, yeah, so you will become the bosses of the company together with two of your youngish uncles, and you'll notice. He said, better salary and we keep doing the same job. That was not the case. The moment we became director, all of a sudden we realized, now we cannot blame anybody except ourselves. And even if it is going wrong and it's not our fault, it is our fault.
Yeah.
And that's almost 30 years ago. So until that time, I was blissfully adolescent manager in yacht building. And now all of a sudden I was a boss, and it's a huge difference. So stepping away from that, it feels wonderful. I mean, Roderick is replacing me as CEO a bit more internally focused than I was, because he's also doing the operational side. And Bas, whom you know well, has moved to board level and is now the first non-family member sitting on the board responsible for commercial affairs and strategy. And only recently you realized it is a different job.
Yeah. Was it a hard decision to arrive at?
No. Tom and I, when we wrote version 2 or 3 of the shareholders agreement in the early 2000s, we started talking about tenure for non-executive directors, be it family or not family, because we have 2 non-family non-executives. And at the moment, 1 family non-executive. I'll be the second. And we were also talking about formal retirement. There was no age in the in-company rules for family members, or for that matter, executives at the highest level. And we then decided that we should put it at the, in Holland, normal mandatory retirement age for employees. And of course, as a family owner, you can do what you want. But the reason for that was that there was, conflict is a bit harsh word, but there was a lot of discussion amongst our predecessors in the 90s about when they were stepping down and who was doing what. And we said, let's make that easy on ourselves. At the time, we were in our early 40s. We thought, well, when we're 60, 62, we'll step out anyway, and we'll take care of a good pension arrangement for ourselves through the years so that we can afford to do that. We did. Then there was a crisis, a small one in 2001. The dot-com crisis. There was a huge one in 2009. Mm. And Tom and I looked at our pension investments and we said, it's going to be a very simple life after 60. And so we said, well, we can still work till we're 65 and we feel healthy. And then you turn 60 and you don't feel any older. You just start to look funny. And then at this time, the retirement age in Holland had been moved to 66, 66.5, 67, simply because pensions in the Netherlands were becoming unaffordable, like France, like Greece.
Like the UK.
Or a little bit like the UK. And at the time, our then government bit the bullet and said, okay, so you have to work longer. When I started with De Vries in the late 80s, the average retirement age for a worker in our company was about 60, because there was a special fund that was partly financed by the employees, but mostly by the employers. If somebody in production had worked more than 40 years, and many of them start before they were 20, then you are entitled to early retirement. And there's a fund that you can dig into to do that. And it became so expensive. So it was gradually phased out. And a thing we look at in the running of our company is how young the staff is. We want to keep sort of a normal, there's a word for it, never mind. We want to have a nice build-up of age through the generations. When I started, the average age in our company was 37, which is young for an industrial production company. I think in the Americas, it's over 50 average. And that gradually has crept up, but almost in line with going from 60 to 67 years retirement. So it's mostly because people simply work longer. And the average age is now in the low 40s, which again, for an industrial company, is not bad. So we wrote that into the rules of the company, which of course we could change at any moment with the majority of the votes. But we said, no, let's stick to it. So 3 years ago, 3.5 by now, we were on one of our holding company directorship brainstorm sessions, sometimes abroad, sometimes in the Netherlands, and that's for the Vries's. So the 2 younger ones who are now filling the void that Tom and I leave behind, Tom and I, and then John, who's our financial director, and Bas, who's our commercial director. John as a member of the board, Bas at that time director of my sales company. So not yet in the board as he is now. And the 6 of us, with typically a professor or coach or whatever, would go somewhere and work on whatever was needing to be worked on. And 3 years ago, we decided to invite a family enterprise professor from Free University Amsterdam to help us, first of all, to make a proper roadmap for how we are going to transfer into the 5th generation. We are 4th. But also to come up with a recipe book on Henk and Tom leaving and the other four guys taking over. And it became a matrix with all the things that we do. So not a literal job description, but all also the informal things that you do. And then all dates below, this one goes to that person, this one goes to that person. Till the last moment, I remained responsible for Makkum, for instance. Tom is still responsible for Aalsmeer. I did it also for a while. Roderick has taken over Aalsmeer, Roderick has taken over Makkum because the Makkum shipyard is run by Tom's brother. So it would be a little bit funny if the brother would report to the brother, so the brother is reporting to the second cousin, and as he was reporting to me. And both of us started running out of operational direct responsibilities middle of last year. And then then the sort of thing, how are we going to lead our life, really kicked in. So I had the better part of a year to come to terms with not being unmissable and instrumental in the company. And it was not hard.
Really? Because I find that transition is really fascinating, because people, I guess, worry about feeling or having a lack of purpose, I suppose, or feeling unneeded.
Yes, but that is extremely selfish. Tom and I, when we were just going through these things, were talking with Justin Redman, who was in the process of selling RWD. Mm. And at one point, we are very good friends. So it was a nice informal dinner that we had. And at one point, Tom made the remark, yeah, Justin, or maybe I did, I don't remember. What am I going to do? And Justin's response was very short and very helpful. He said, that's very selfish. You're the boss of the company. You have to do what is best for the company. And for you, yeah, whatever is best for you, but apparently it's not work, so better work on something else. So that was, for me at least, tremendously helpful that you realize, and it is true. I had a professor in university who was the founder of one of the largest management consulting firms in the Netherlands with at one point hundreds of employees. He stepped away from daily operations, but remained executive director when he was 55. And he stepped away from that role when he was 60. And he did less and less and less until he was 65. And he wrote about it as a professor who was advising companies. And of course, our clients don't understand. They say, hey, I'm 75. Everything's still working. I'm running my company. But quite often, those are the entrepreneurs who started the business. Those are the John Bannenbergs. And now I'm going to hurt some people. The John Bannenbergs, the Walter Huismans, the Mike Kelsey, Paolo Vitelli. All those people, they could not leave because they were the person that was also the company. Mm. The advantage of having gone through generational transfer before, it's very interesting. Great-grandfather started the company, two sons started a separate company. So second generation was a different enterprise that finally merged the original one into itself. So that's why we call it second generation. Second stayed in power from between, let's say, 1930s until late 60s. They sold their shares, there were three guys, to five of their sons. So that was a financial transaction. It was not handing over. It was not inherited. So already in the second to the third generation, there was a very conscious decision in the De Vries family to pass it on. Then when three was stepping down and four was moving in, interesting, not all of them followed that route. Some of them indeed waited until they passed. Some of them died quite young, early into retirement. So there was a whole family now taking care of a share. And some of them did an actual financial transfer to a child, like my father did with me, like Rob de Vries' father did with him. And one family, there's one of the five uncles still alive, Gerard, Roderick's father. And he consciously said, no, Roderick, you're my son. There's two daughters. I want the three of you to run this, and you better work out how you do it properly, but make good rules amongst yourselves. So that's also a way to do it. So it's been a very conscious process.
Yeah, but it's also cultural. It's ingrained. You know, there's no expectation that the company will kind of die with you, as it were. You are, you know, there's a familial understanding that.
Yeah. With that professor of family enterprise, we had enormous discussions at that session 3 years ago because he was trying to label us as an entrepreneurial family. Mm. In other words, the family as a group is entrepreneurial, running a company. We're beyond that point because we are now five equal 20% shareholding entities, two individuals, one brother with sisters because the father wanted it, and two families. So if there is talk of an entrepreneurial family, it's within one of those five. Mm. And we are developing that now because the De Vries family is quite fertile. If you look at the second generation and their spin-off and what they found in spouses and what have you, there's 300 of them. But only a small group owns the company. So what we've done so far is we've asked this professor of family enterprise and a colleague to start the De Vries Academy. And the academy, at the beginning, is only for our own children. But that's already 22 in the five shareholding entities. So the 22, and each may send one person to be the boss on behalf of that branch. What do you do if there are four super talented people in one branch and only not so nice, not so smart people in another? That's and we're in the middle of that. But there's an in-generation transfer going on at the moment. Because I left, Tom is leaving in March. There'll be a huge party in April, May next year for the both of us. And Rob and Roderick are the same generation, but their fathers are quite a bit younger than ours. So the guys are 15 years younger than we are. So they're literally half a generation behind us. So the nice thing is, for the coming 10, 12, 15 years, De Vries is in calm waters. And I think the fifth generationers who are between 12 and 30 years old, those 22 kids, will start banging on the door, let's say, 5-6 years from now. So then we have to have made up our mind how we want to transfer to the fifth.
And will you have some influence in that?
If I'm still a shareholder and non-executive director, yes. But it depends. It depends as long as I keep my shares and there's no age limit to that. So I can remain a non-executive board member for as long as I personally want. But my thinking is I want to pass it on to my son if he is interested, but he's still in the middle of his studies. And if I don't do that, I have several options. I can pass it on to another family member or sell the shares back to the company, and then there are four shareholders. So those are the options. And the final option is to sell it to an outsider, but we've made that very unattractive.
Yeah, prohibitively expensive.
No, not expensive, but you really have to go through the family first and enter into serious negotiation. Typical Dutch contract stuff, in good faith and stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, for you as a young man, was it always, do you feel it was your destiny? Was there any attempt not to, or did you always feel like this was just your path and you would always be?
No. When I was in university, I made bets with my friends that I would never join a bloody family business. And I studied economics in the 80s. And everybody who studied the business side of economics wanted to be a management consultant and work for McKinsey. So me too. So I joined a management consulting firm. I was a little bit disappointed by the impact that I had. And after a relatively short period of a few years, my father said, "Are you coming? Or because if not, your brother works in the company, but he is not director material. If you don't come, then I have to look outside the family for my succession." And I said, okay, I wanted to switch jobs anyway, but I'm not quite sure if that is for me. I was 29. I said, let me do a job interview with your four cousins, and then I'll find out. Job interview? What do you need a job interview for? I said, I'd like to sort of know what sort of people they are and if they think it's necessary that I come, even though you seem to think so. And then two of the interviews were like, you studied economics. You're an MBA. My gosh, we're just building simple boats with about 100 people. You're overqualified. You will be so bored. And I was very impressed with the entrepreneurship in those five. So I joined. And after a few years, I said, I'll stay. And then my father and I opened discussions to take over his shares. So, and only when I became shareholder and director in 1996 is when I felt, okay, now I'm stuck. And then my wife, for the first time, said, never stuck, you can always walk away. So, yeah, but I felt committed.
But no regrets. I mean, what a career.
No. I was, our predecessor were very modest people. And I was really stupid. You can't imagine that. But of course, pre-internet, you had some magazines, you had a Lodge Register. There was not really a clear picture who was who and who was doing what. And I did the first FedShip market analysis, came back. That was in the 88 or 89 that I had my first diagrams. I said, are you guys aware that FedShip has 30% market share? They said, what? Ah, of course, there's Benetti. And I said, yeah, but you built rather a lot of boats between the two of you. Really? So, and that was, of course, not a stable situation. So the markets exploded the first time in the early 90s. And FedShip market share is now consistently, depending a little bit on how you measure, between 8 and 12% or so, which is still quite a big portion. But they were indeed unaware. And I also didn't know. It was so interesting. Very first time I went on a business trip, I was maybe a week employed in 1987. Went to meet a client. How the client meeting went, from a guy who has a commercial background, because I worked as a salesman during my studies, is a separate story. But I came away not too impressed with how FedShip was selling stuff. On the dock was a yacht broker. I didn't know what a yacht broker was. The guy saw me, shook my hand. Remember, this is before the internet. And he said, oh, you're the one who went to university. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, my father said, we're sort of famous. So, yeah. And of course, when you're in that position and you're doing well and you're finding out, and I was finding out how good the people were, it sounds silly maybe, but it is easy to sell stuff. There's always a debate about price. There always will be. But there was never especially after we got our marketing a bit more together, let's say towards the late 90s, early 2000s, when I started my dance and sing about the FedShip quality, quite often the customer would interrupt me and say, yeah, I know all that. My friends told me and I've been on your boats, but how much is it? So, and that's wonderful to have that as a starting position and enviable.
Yeah. So the new role, ambassador.
Yes.
So what does that entail exactly?
The incoming De Vries cousins are less externally focused than Tom and I. And of course, they will have to develop that a bit more. But Tom and I love that part of our job. So we don't mind if they send us out I think there will be a little sorting out of things, maybe occasionally. But it's more... One thing we're not so good at FedShip, we have this incredibly loyal client base and relationship network. But apart from traveling to people when you're either building a boat or in the process of discussing to sell one, we spend not enough time just going out there saying, hello, I'm in California. Hello, Californian customers. Shall we have a coffee? And quite often people say, oh, it's nice that you come. And mostly you're just talking about the world in general, yachting, if that comes up. But occasionally they will say, maybe time for a new boat. Or they say, the boat needs a big job. Do you guys do maintenance? Or they say, I have this friend. You should meet him. And we simply don't have the time for that. And Tom and I will. And we don't mind sitting in an airplane and in a nice hotel and meeting nice people. Not as a daily job. So that's one part of the ambassador thing. And the other part is, don't underestimate the feeling of, hey, Mr. De Vries, it's coming into a meeting, even if it's only for 5 minutes, you know. People like that. I remember when Fritz Vogt retired. He retired in 94, and until 2000, he was occasionally meeting up with customers who were just interested in meeting this person.
Well, I think that's the challenge. A lot of people, when your name's above the door, as it were, it's... And there's other companies facing a similar challenge in our industry. When one person holds a lot of the owner relationships, it's quite hard to hand them over to the next generation often. Because
well, I on customer side, I've already have started handing over to Bas and Marcia and our peer from 5 years ago, I would say.
But if this omega owner says, I only want to deal with Henk,
that will disappear. Because yes, if it's somebody I know and have done business with, it's an obvious request and they'll bring Henk out. If it's a new generation person who's new to FedShip, initial contact will be with non-family commercial people. And then eventually, or maybe already the second meeting, Rob or Roderick will show up and there's Mr. De Vries.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So your newfound time will be spent, presumably, a lot of car, further your enthusiasm in the world of motor cars. And we were talking before we started recording about what you've got in the garage at the moment. So for those listening who don't know, Henk is a true petrol head. So Henk, what have you got in the garage?
Well, too many, but I go through change. I'm becoming, it could become a business, Stuart. I keep a list of everything I own, but there's also a list of everything I owned. The list of what I owned has become longer than the list of what I own, and I own 35 at the moment.
You've got 35 cars. Wow.
Yeah, and I owned about 50 before, so yeah. I'm on my way to having experience hands-on with about 100 classic automobiles from between middle 50s to middle 70s.
So they're classics?
All
of them are classics, okay.
Now, I don't get excited by modern cars at all. Although I did have an Aston Martin Rapide, which is one of the nicest petrol cars that I ever owned, modern. And I'm driving a Toyota Mirai, which is hydrogen powered.
Oh wow!
So that's put your money where your mouth is, because the company wants to become clean, and I wanted to investigate what hydrogen.
Yeah. So obviously you've got a huge fondness for Aston Martins, and I was just wondering if that helped in any negotiations with the owner of the various faiths that you have built.
No, that's a very logical question, and the answer is no. Firstly, I've never been a customer for the modern product. And of course, as owner of the company, you are most interested in selling stuff, competing with the other high-end car manufacturers. And secondly, it is a personal business. And part of the family charm is that there are more flavors to the family De Vries. And Tom has a completely different flavor from me. And he and the owner have a very warm personal relationship.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm part of that relationship, being a member of the family, but Tom is the man.
So with Tom and your working relationship over the last four decades, I mean, how does that work? How do the dynamics of that duo work?
Well, we've been friends all our lives. We grew up together. Our families were close in proximity of each other, but also close friends. So, and there were four children in each of the two families, and even all the kids were sort of friends with the person of similar age. Tom and I were very close friends. We went to different elementary and middle schools, but we both joined, this gets corny, we both joined the club of the Reformed Church, because that was the only place we were allowed to go to when we were 17 for a beer on Sunday night. And there were girls there. So we were very close friends through the time that we were a member of this club. Then I went off and went to university. Tom went to technical school and started to work at a company at a quite young age, in his early 20s. And we didn't really drift apart, but we had a different social life. But we would still go out together quite often, go to concerts together. But we really came back together when about 6-7 years later, I also joined the company. Initially, there were no job descriptions. There was no formal evaluation program, especially not for family members. So we sort of found our way through this unclearly run, controlled, paternalistic five directors and employees, even though there was middle management. They were ignored if it was convenient to do so. So very much entrepreneurial feel to the company, even though then the company was already over 50 years old. Tom and I started first with what we called a management team. So the two of us plus three or four non-family managers. And that eventually evolved into job descriptions, formal evaluation talks. And that was really in the 90s, before we became directors, the beginning of a more professional organization. When we started, when Tom started the company, he didn't even have 100 people. When I started, it had 120. When we became directors, it was about 150, 160 with a turnover in euros then. 1996, probably 20, 25 million euros. It's almost 20 times that now. And we have over 1,000 employees. And that you can blame us for that. And I was always the optimist and the opportunist and the sales guy. And Tom was the hands-on guy in production, the guy who connected with the people in the shipyard on a very fundamental level, and who they always could talk to. And also sometimes the guy saying, Ink, sorry, now you have to shut up. We're not going to do it like that. So it was a very harmonious and sometimes disharmonious, but always respectful balance between the two. And we were in our heyday. So before Rob and Roderick joined, we were formidable. There is a Dutch system with workers' representation in the company. And we did the, what was it, monthly meetings with this group of craftsmen. And at a certain point, they said to us, you shouldn't sit next to each other because you're communicating so sharply, we cannot get between you. So then we said, oh, no problem. And there were about 8 in the workers' representation. So I was sitting here, there were 4 people there. Tom was sitting there, there were 4 people there. And still the same was happening. They said, are you guys clairvoyant or something? I said, we just know each other very well. And we run this company. We disagree on many things in the execution, but we don't disagree on how we feel the company should be run. Mm. And it was phenomenal.
Well, you've got quite complementary skill sets then, ultimately, if he's more...
We did. Yeah. Purely coincidence. Yeah.
And that, you know, and the two of you stewarded this amazing historic brand through the most wild period of growth the superyacht industry has ever seen. I mean, it's still only a second or third generation industry, really. I mean, it took off in the 80s, really exploded in the 90s and the 2000s. I mean, and that was you. I mean, that was you guys. You were in the mix. You were right in the middle of all that. So that must have felt incredible.
And terrifying sometimes.
Yeah, I bet.
There was a project in Makkum. We bought Makkum in 2005 from Damen. And we did not buy the company. We just bought the premises and we took over 72 of the 120 people. We're quite proud of how we put that together rather quickly. And the first project was not turning a loss, which was a surprise. But after that, we've had some very big holes in the road. Because the scale of things compared to where we were coming from was sometimes staggering, both in complexity, but also in sheer size. Mm. And that was not always easy.
And I suppose some people look at our industry, particularly building big boats, and they think that there's mega profits involved. It's it's not the case at all. It's a tight margin game.
Yeah, that is one thing that we didn't manage to solve. We are curiously looking at our successors to do that better. It is ridiculous that you build these high-risk things from scratch and are happy when you make a 5% profit.
Yeah.
We calculate with 10, but we hardly ever make it, and quite often it's closer to zero. It's stupid.
That means
in that respect, our market is not yet mature.
Yeah.
Because everybody understands that an LVMA briefcase is probably double what it costs to manufacture. But hey, you're buying that thing. And we are, as of yet, are incapable of selling that to the client. So that's a nice challenge for the next generation.
Yeah, it is a challenge. How do we overcome it? How do we make people... How do you fatten the margins in the boat building business?
There is still too much unprofessional attitude from the supply side, which makes the clients wonder, even in the case of the Vetships and Lursens and Abekings of this world, if you are in the camp of the people who spin stories or the people who are honest when they say, we don't make a lot of money.
And I mean, and again, in that 40 years, I mean, you've seen some great times, but you've also seen some hard times. You mentioned some earlier, obviously, dot-com crash, global financial crisis. And, you know, and the industry at the right as we speak is experiencing, you know, a bit of a pause while everyone figures out what's happening in the world. You know, and there can be frightening times for all businesses in this sector, because there's no one in this sector, no one, certainly not on the media side and on the shipbuilding side, that is, you know, getting rich off this game, really. I mean, it is a hard grafting way to make a living. I mean, the rewards are fantastic, and the opportunities are fantastic, the people you meet, but, you know, it's hard business.
It is. And that in itself is fine. And there has been tremendous growth in the period 2003-2008. That's over, and I don't think it's ever coming back. Mm. And if there is growth, then the serious growth is probably going to be in a not custom sector. So in production side, because then relatively unemotionally you can buy something that is nice quality, reliable, plenty of them. So there is markets also for secondhand. So it's overseeable for the majority of people. I consider what we are in, let's say 50 meters and up custom build, will always be a niche in the market. And as long as you master that, the entry barriers are tremendous. The entry barriers in financial sense are not so tremendous, because there's always companies going out of business. So you can buy a building, you can find people if you employ them quickly enough, and then restart. But how do you make that profitable? And we are quite good at that, even though the profit could be better. But we are consistently, as a company, turning a profit for the past 15 years. And that has not happened to us ever before. So the company is doing well enough, and we are on a trajectory to get better. Mm. So I'm quite positive about the future.
It's interesting what you said about whether the market's rationalizing around more series and production builds. And we're certainly seeing that in the statistics. We see more and more semi-custom production getting bigger and bigger all the time. So it becomes a bit more like the car world, I suppose, when, you know, there used to be the world of coach builders. You could have one-offs, but that basically doesn't really exist anymore. So you'll buy a series or a line or, you know, hull 17 of whatever. I mean, it's certainly an easier way. It's a simpler way to operate a business in our sector, it seems.
Exactly. And so then it becomes more corporate. Then the kids who studied business economics and logistics and stuff like that, they can work their magic, and probably not realizing, because they're young and inexperienced, that by doing that, they're moving the company maybe into a more comfortable, understandable, manageable, projectable environment, but making it virtually impossible to enter the custom domain.
Because once you're out,
it's completely different.
Yeah, it's hard to.
I see that animals. I respect them greatly as a good competitor, but if they in their current form would try to do custom, it would probably kill them.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose whole modes of production have changed to, you know, fit us.
Yes. And we are doing it, and I'm happy to explain a little bit about that, because it's difficult to duplicate. What we are doing, we have standardized the process in 2010, when we were coming out of hardship in Mockum. We had to, because otherwise the company probably would have gone bankrupt in 2010 or 11. So we reinvented our business. We started analyzing in November 2009. We put a program together in December 2009, so before Christmas, a month later. We had an outside consultant. We identified the top 40 in our then 500 employees. We took critical people from the whole company and put them in a group, in a pressure group, which meant that some work didn't get done. We lost a fortune on one boat. We broke even on the next one, which was a sister ship, within a year. And the difference was dozens, millions. Then we, in the crisis, were forced to contract at relatively sharp prices. So we sold projects below cost price and turned them out with a small profit. That was a reset of the company. What we're going through at the moment, we're still updating it continuously, so we're not doing a 2.0, 3.0. We don't name them because it is a dynamic thing. Since then, we've implemented concurrent design. We made, I don't know if you saw them at the Arts or at De Voogd, the Miracle Room, where we have simultaneous developments, which came out of a spaceship building. And finally, what we are now doing is we're scaling standardization, because everything can be standardized. And then if a custom boat builder tells you, yeah, Hank, but we cannot standardize the hatches on the boat because here we have so much room, there we have so much room. I'm not joking. We were making those individually. So we said, well, maybe you can standardize the hinges. Sure. So why don't you? Yeah, because that guy is doing it like this and this guy is doing it like that. Which one is better? Akerbos, they have cut this down to a science. So they're building custom Riviera gangways, custom cranes, but they're all made of standard components. So they have all these components standard on the shelf. And at a certain point, they realize, oh, this component is made up out of four parts. But if I integrate it with the other one out of 20 parts, I have now one subsystem of 25 parts. It's basically the same on each one. I just have to change the power, you know, whatever. It's fucking complicated. But it's great fun.
But worthwhile.
Yeah.
And when you as De Vries achieve innovations like this or standardizations, or you there's a new learning to make the business more efficient, is that freely shared with the Van Lent arm of FedShip?
Yes.
There's an easy cross-pollination of skills and expertise and learnings.
Well, it depends a little bit. Both companies have their fetishes. So that means that sometimes the not invented ear syndrome still exists. So that means that sometimes it will take some time, but in the end, there's one smart way of doing things. But sometimes the smart of the one can be taken by the other and improved upon. And that's been happening for at least the past 20 years, also in the time of Dick Van Lent 20 years ago, but more and more to this day.
Yeah. So, well, it's kind of crazy not to do it, I suppose. I mean, because some people struggle to understand how the two kind of shipyards align, I suppose, under one brand. I mean, you are, in a sense, competitors, but you also share, you know, contacts, network, you know.
Yeah, more and more. As the boats get bigger, we do more collaboration on the huge projects where we also share resources.
Yeah. And just looking to the future, I know you're heavily involved in the Water Revolution Foundation, which is a great industry initiative. I mean, this was a particular, I suppose, passion point of yours, wasn't it? I mean, you are very much driving, I suppose, the greening agenda of the superyacht industry. So, and that's important to you just because it's the right thing to do, but also because that's where the market's going to be in the future, presumably.
Yeah, it's not coming from the markets or from the right thing to do. Both of those, the right thing to do because you want to leave a nice planet for your kids. And the markets, as you know, I've worked very closely with Steve Jobs over a number of years. And I learned a lot from him. And one of the things he always said, the market doesn't know what it wants. You have to show it something. And if you've done it right, they will buy many of them. And that is my approach to the market in this respect. The market doesn't care. Some individuals in the market care, but they're still a minority. However, two things play a role. One is the most important for me to be so committed about this. The one for me is survival of the business. We make a luxury product that is critiqued, because it can be considered antisocial or obnoxious or in your face or whatever. But bottom line, nobody needs a yacht. You need an airplane to get from A to B. You need a private jet if you get from A to B very often. At least you can justify it. You need a big boat to transport your goods from one side of the planet to the other. You don't need a yacht to go from one port to the next and back to the original one without having transported anything but people. So, given the fact that the product is not necessary, given the fact it's using scarce resources, and then on top of that polluting, sorry, you just can't get away with that long term. That is the main reason. I think yachting has no future if we, and I'm passionate about this also as a coordinator, I don't understand the car industry. I honestly don't. I understand China. I understand Toyota. I don't understand BMW. I don't understand Volkswagen. They are in the process of killing themselves by asking for extension of rules that they can still build polluting products. I think it's a dead end. And when we, as Yating, and here comes the trick, Yating is a tiny sector. It is not even 3-4% of the total volume of business in shipping and shipbuilding as a whole. Our footprint is tiny because the boats don't move so much. So it is easy and it is possible today to get a zero footprint of both production and operation of these boats. If you look, for instance, at the green alternative for diesel, the HVO, the recycled frying pan fat, it's made as a byproduct of the emission, the low emission fuel for airplanes. The total production of this fuel for the airplanes is not even 2% of what they burn per year. The availability of the stuff that you can stick in a boat, you can power the entire fleet of about 5,000 boats over 35, 40 meters long, and not even make a dent in supply. So, and you could do that today. And then look at fuel cells, the way the technology is moving. We can already project that in 2030, boats can be built that have no emission. Boats are designed now, as we speak, to have no emission. I look at my competition. San Lorenzo is doing something. Lursen is doing something. Most companies are doing nothing. And the sailboat companies are making a small noise, but their noise gets smaller each year. I think they really dropped the ball 10 years ago. Sailboat companies were the best starting point for emission-free boating because they are, in principle, possible to run emission-free. And they, for some reason, didn't capitalize on that. We decided, even though the new car market was not asking for it, by only 5 years ago, early 2020, promoting electric drive boats. The back end of each fed ship is now electric. There's power generated that makes electricity, and that power is used to drive the boat. So it's not a hybrid. It is electric drive. And that means, effectively, I still use diesel motors to make the power, and I have big battery packs. So there's a bit of innovation there. The big difference is you never have brownouts or blackouts anymore. You always have power. We put solar panels on, and you can debate how effective that is, but everything helps and everything is interesting. And we are now, as we speak, developing boats that will not only carry diesel or HVO in their tanks, but are also capable of carrying methanol. We have, as you know, just finished the first hydrogen-powered boats, which is, at least for part of the operation, already capable of operating completely emission-free. And I'm looking at the statistics in the market. How many electric drive boats? More than half of those are ours. So I'm in a good place. That we, and that is also the goal for Water Revolution, in principle, our emission can be emission-free in 2030. It's only 5 years away. It looks like very far or close, but it's possible. It doesn't mean you have to do it, but the role for Water Revolution is to show the roadmap how to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. 2030. Wow. Just around the corner.
Yep. Yeah. Because we sold out 2028. We're selling 2029 now, and next year we'll be selling 2030. So my successor better have a couple of green boats in there. Otherwise, I haven't lived up to my promise. And I'm on the board critically monitoring.
Yeah.
Not hindered by day-to-day concerns.
But, I mean, it's something you'll remain involved with the Water Revolution Foundation. You obviously.
Somebody who founded that foundation put in the rules that the tenure of a board member is 3 years and you have, in principle, 2 terms.
Okay.
Because I hate boards with. I'm not mentioning CBAS here. I hate boards where people just keep hanging on because nobody else wants to do the job. If nobody wants to do the job, then apparently the institution has no goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Turnover is good.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a FedShip. I mean, that's something you've learned.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it is important to get new voices, new ideas, younger people involved in the organization.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you what is probably an impossible question. Can you pick a boat from the last 40 years that you have built that is your favorite?
There's a few, or for different reasons. But it's the smallest, Stuart. It's the smallest. Aurora is on there, built in the early 90s. And it was a modern classic Fed ship that inspired a whole fleet of boats that are similar to it. Susuro, late 90s, first water jet boat, super light, below weight budgets. And we even made, I think, 400,000 guilders profit. one of those things the rational boat builders of today wouldn't do. Maybe, but it spawned Detroit Eagle with turbine power. It was the inspiration for Ecstasy, which was an incredible machine. Then Venus, because of the owner and then because of the innovation on the glass and the style. When we built the boat, I thought everybody would want that style, but it took 10 years for the market to adopt the straight bows. And now I see some competitors from countries that I shall not mention who put a nice stainless steel thing in the front, exactly like Venus. Whereas we improved it, we don't put stainless steel in front anymore. We put glass in front.
Yeah.
As we did on Obsidian. Obsidian also a definite favorite. So the theme is shape, prettiness, and advanced build engineering, be it construction or power or what have you. Very similar to my attitude when I buy another car.
What's on the shopping list next? What are you looking at now?
I started looking at Ferrari from the 1950s because they're coming down. But my valuer tells me there's a reason they're coming down. People who like those cars are all dead. So similar to the early 1950 Bentley R-Type Continental, I had one of those and I sold it just in time. Because, man, they're going down. So on the shopping list, I still need a Lancia Aurelia 3rd Series from 1953. And they're difficult to find at a cheap enough price to destroy it and build something else on it.
A Lancia Aurelia 3 from 1950. Okay. Anyone listening to this got one to sale?
There's 700 of them, and I'm willing to pay about 100,000 for a car that doesn't need to be in top condition.
Okay. We'll get a sales commission if we deliver a lead, right?
Oh, 5%, no problem.
Thank you, Hank. What are you doing for the rest of the day?
Nothing. Excellent. It's great weather.
What a brilliant thing to be able to say.
A coffee in the sun and reading a newspaper.
That sounds like a dream. But
here comes coffee, and the girl says, "With a nice woman."
Hello.
Hey. Well.
All right, and thanks for the great party. We had a wonderful time.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a good weekend in Venice, wasn't it? Yeah. And another award for you guys. I mean, you must have lost count of the amount of World Superyacht Awards you've won over the years.
We're very proud of each one of them.
As you should be.
Well, okay, Stuart.
Congratulations on such an incredible career. And this has been a real joy. So thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Hank de Vries, ladies and gents, a true great of our business. We'll be back with more next week, so don't forget to like and subscribe to the Boat Briefing podcast, which is a production of Boat International Media.